The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
We find the defendant, Hannah Gutierrez, guilty of involuntary manslaughter as charged in count one. We find the defendant, Hannah Gutierrez, not guilty of tampering with evidence as charged in count two.
After just 2.5 hours of deliberations, a New Mexico jury found Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the armorer on the set of the movie Rust, guilty of involuntary manslaughter for the death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins. She was shot and killed when a live round from a gun held by actor Alec Baldwin fired during rehearsal in 2021. Juror Alberto Sanchez explained why they came to their decision.
Pretty much it was just that never did the safety checks, never checked the rounds to pull them out, to look at them, shake them. I mean, if you'd have done that, this wouldn't have happened.
The defense had argued that Gutierrez Reed was a fall guy, and the ultimate responsibility rested with producers, including Baldwin.
Hannah is being made a scapegoat for our deliberate errors and mistakes by production.
Now all eyes turn to Baldwin's own involuntary manslaughter trial, which begins on July 10th. Joining me is former prosecutor Joshua Kastenberg, a professor at the University of New Mexico Law School. A two-week trial, very short jury deliberations. What was the critical prosecution evidence?
I think one is the prosecution did a very good job of proving that Hannah Gutierrez Reed had a duty and that she failed to perform the basic functions of that duty, and that is to make sure the firearms are safe. Now, the prosecution had not only the normal hurdle of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, they also understood that one of the defenses would be that, look, other people had access to the guns, and the armor isn't the only one responsible for this. But they focused on her specific responsibilities, and they were able to get in some evidence of drug use. And I think those were the two strengths of the case. And frankly, the defense didn't put up a compelling defense, even though it's not their burden to do so. They didn't.
So one of the jurors said that they'd easily reached their decision by determining that Gutierrez Reed had failed to properly carry out gun safety checks. The big question has been, why was there live ammunition on the movie set, which is strictly forbidden? The prosecution said that Gutierrez Reed brought the live rounds to the set and showed some photos to prove that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there is evidence, you know, where the live rounds came from. I don't think it's, you know, it's conclusive beyond a reasonable doubt, but there is evidence that it came from her. I think what that evidence really proves is she knew of the possibility that live rounds would be in the vicinity of the weapon and failed to do anything to stop it from entering the weapon or keeping it in the weapon.
I mean, let's talk about how this affects Baldwin's trial. If she's responsible for the live ammunition on the set, that helps him, doesn't it?
Well, his attorneys have looked at this case, I have no doubt, very carefully. And not only very carefully, but with an eye towards presenting evidence in their own case. And I think, ironically, the stronger the prosecution's case is against Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the weaker it is against Baldwin, even though those are two separate trials with two different theories of guilt.
Does this verdict in any way absolve Baldwin of negligence?
Well, it doesn't absolve him of negligence, because you can have a criminal negligence series of crimes where there are multiple people who had duties to perform or avoid performing certain things, and yet they're all guilty, even though those duties are disparate. But then there's the human logic, and the human logic will go something like this. The more guilty she is, the less he is, because really, what was his role? Now, the prosecution did a great job in this first trial. Their next focus has to be getting to the point where the individual who last had their hand on the gun had an independent responsibility to make sure the gun was safeguarded. That's a true statement, but whether it rises to the level of a crime, the failure to do that or not, that's a tough mountain to climb.
The prosecutors used videos from the set to portray a breakdown of movie industry firearms safety standards. The defense tried to show that the producers were trying to cut costs. They rushed the crew. They gave her too many things to do because she was both a part-time armorer and a prop assistant. That's the producer's fault. But Baldwin is one of the producers.
And, you know, if the prosecution pursues that line, they go up against Baldwin, he's not just an actor. He had a greater role in the movie, on the Rust movie set, than a normal actor would have. And they'll try to tie him in as being complicit in those failures. And there's a possibility they'll be able to do so.
What I found interesting is that there was testimony that he exerted a disproportionate amount of power because he was serving as producer, writer, and
right.
lead actor. He was described by one witness as the boss, and no one says no to him. That's important.
It's very important, yeah. I mean, he's not just the lead actor. You know, Hollywood is not the military, but there are defined leadership roles in the movie industry, and it's clear that he took one of them. And so there's responsibility that comes with taking one of them.
A firearms expert said that Baldwin was basically instructing the armorer how to do their job.
Yeah, you know, the armorer would have an independent duty to push back. But I think the prosecution tried to tailor this case against Hannah Gutierrez Reed, preserving enough strong evidence against Baldwin to go after him in that trial. And I think they did a pretty good job of doing it. It's just that the prosecution of Alec Baldwin is going to be considerably harder than it was against the armorer.
I sort of wonder why they're going after Baldwin, since they found out that the armorer, or they believe the armorer, brought the ammunition to the set. She didn't do proper safety checks before the incident.
You're going to hear competing theories about why they're going after Baldwin. For example, one theory is they want publicity. I don't believe that's true, but that is going to be something that's advocating that he's a big person to take down and the like. You're going to hear another competing theory, which is we only have one system of justice in this country, and there's been this unfortunate narrative that there's two systems of justice, one for the top 1% and one for the rest of us. But I also think that there's a fundamental issue here, and that is the person who had their finger on the trigger should have the justice system focused on them as well, out of fairness, because they're the one who pulled the trigger without looking at the gun, without doing the final safety check and the like. And I actually think that's the most basic and real reason why the prosecution's going forward on it. Having said that, Baldwin is a very gifted defense counsel. And, you know, they're going to make an equation to, for example, you rent a car when you land at the airport from a reputable car rental company. Your assumption when you turn the ignition in on the car is up to safety standards, you know? And so that's what they're going to equate it to.
Baldwin maintains and has maintained since day one that he didn't pull the trigger. And there's going to be testimony from gun experts that it couldn't have fired without pulling the trigger. How important
right.
is that?
Well, that cuts both ways. Because if you have an FBI or you have a firearms expert, a real expert saying, look, this gun was fired because the trigger was depressed. And it makes it appear that Baldwin wasn't telling the truth. That can hurt him. On the other hand, what I'd say about it is maybe he absolutely believes that he didn't pull the trigger because the human mind is fallible. And that's why, for example, when a railroad accident occurs or a plane crash accident occurs, the National Transportation Safety Board, when they do mass interviews of people, they don't give the interviews individualized credibility because everybody has a different story as to what they saw. And our minds are conditioned, particularly during a stressful moment, to capture and retain data and then shape the data in a manner that makes sense to us, even though it may not be an accurate reflection of what occurred. And so if you remember, there was a plane after 9/11 that crashed in Long Island. There were witnesses who said there was a giant fireball. There were witnesses who said the wings fell off the airplane. All kinds of stories as to what happened. It turned out there was no fireball. There was no explosion. There was a plane crash because the plane broke apart. But if you're the person with your finger on the trigger, your brain may actually synthesize the data that occurred, you know, the recall, to say you had nothing to do with it. It just went off, even though your finger did it, you know. So I don't think that the prosecution is going to spend a lot of time trying to paint Baldwin as a liar. They're going to try to paint him as irresponsible.
And in this case, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed did not take the witness stand.
Yeah.
But do we expect that Alec Baldwin will take the witness stand?
Well, you know, taking the witness stand is ultimately a defendant's choice, and it's not the defense counsel's choice. I mean, they can just advise. And it's a risk for him to take the stand. It's also a risk for him not to. The judge instructs the jury that they're to infer no guilt whatsoever from any defendant who does not testify in their own defense. That's true, but he's an actor, and him taking the witness stand, the risk is he has to be genuine as to who he is. If he takes the stand and tells the truth, as he sees it, but if the jury thinks he's acting through it, they're going to hold it against him. So he's in the most unique category of defendant that I could think of.
Looking at the evidence that came in and how it was received by the jury, which side do you think has the advantage, the prosecution or Baldwin?
Well, I think that the prosecution tried to preserve as much of the strength as they could in the evidence to be used against Baldwin. Having said that, I could see that Baldwin's attorneys might call the New Mexico OSHA person to testify. They may call witnesses who brought in evidence about Hannah Gutierrez-Reed's drug use to say that, look, my client wasn't aware that she was under the influence of marijuana or cocaine during this time on the movie set. So I think that it tilts slightly in favor of Baldwin. I mean, you could still get a conviction out of this evidence, but it's much harder to do so.
We'll find out in July. Thanks so much, Josh. That's Professor Joshua Kastenberg of the University of New Mexico Law School. Coming up next, what the liberal justices were worried about in the Supreme Court's decision keeping Trump on the ballot. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
On the surface, the Supreme Court was unanimous on Monday in ruling that Donald Trump can appear on presidential ballots. But just below the surface, there was plenty of conflict. In a per curiam opinion, all nine justices concluded that states can't enforce the insurrection clause to bar federal candidates from the ballot. But the three liberal justices wrote a caustic concurrence, which read like a dissent, saying the five conservatives had gone too far. And conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote her own, more restrained concurrence. Joining me is Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School and host of the Passing Judgment podcast. Jessica, explain the reasoning of the per curiam opinion, which all nine justices agreed to, why they decided that Donald Trump should remain on the ballot.
I wouldn't frame this so much as should Donald Trump remain on the ballot as does any single state have the power under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to say that a presidential candidate is ineligible for office. And the top line here is that nine of the justices agreed that when it comes to a state, they do not have the power for federal officials, particularly for the president, to say that they're disqualified for office, having been previously serving in government, engaging in insurrection, and then trying to once again serve in government.
You have two concurrences, one by all three of the liberal justices and one by Amy Coney Barrett. In the liberal justices' concurrence, that read more like a dissent. They said that the five conservatives went too far, further than they needed to go. Explain They decide novel constitutional questions to insulate this court and petitioner, that's Trump, from future controversy. Explain what they were concerned about there.
So I think what the concurrence, which really does read more like a dissent, is concerned about is, one, that the court answered a question that wasn't asked. That they said not only can a state not by itself say that there's a federal candidate who's ineligible for office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but here's who can. It's just Congress, and it's just through a certain type of legislation. And so the first problem the concurrence has is this idea that, in fact, the per curiam, and as they phrase it, the majority, is just going too far. And they're answering a question that they didn't need to, and that that violates the principle of judicial restraint. And then the second thing they're saying about insulating, and I think this wasn't clear, and I wish they had just said what they mean, mm-hmm. but I suspect what they mean is that by the majority saying, here's the way that you enforce Section 3. It's congressional legislation that is specifically aimed at and narrowly tailored, aimed at the issue that the Constitution lays out, that what they're saying is, does that mean then if Donald Trump, for instance, was to win the election and then Congress was to try not to certify under a different statute, under the Electoral Count Act, would Congress then lack the power to do that under this majority opinion?
And during the oral arguments, the lawyer for the Colorado voters had said that a rule requiring congressional action to implement Section 3 could leave the door open to a renewed fight over trying to use the provision to disqualify Trump in the event that he wins the election. So those five conservatives knew what they were doing.
I think these conservatives did know what they were doing. This was discussed in oral argument. I think that there's a question as to whether or not it's appropriate or not for the per curiam to have gone further than just Colorado lacks this power. But it certainly is the case that there was a conversation about whether or not a specific type of judicial decision would just kick the can down the road. And I think that's what the concurrence is really arguing here, the concurrence by the liberals, which is you're just pushing off some big and complicated questions until later. And specifically, those big questions, you're actually tilting the scale in favor of saying that Congress would lack the power to take any action outside of a new piece of legislation, and that that's helpful not just for Trump, but for the court itself in avoiding future controversy.
Well, do you think that there was a push, you know, to speak with one voice, and so the three liberals went along with that? Was this really a unanimous decision?
It really was a unanimous decision that was deeply fractured on everything else other than the one line of the outcome. So on the one hand, you can see that there's this enormous pressure because it's a case with huge political consequences and huge consequences on an issue that really divides our country, that the court not look like they're policymakers. So the court look like they are judges. They are resolving disputes. They are not putting their thumb on the scale of an election. And so I think that's how we do get to that one line saying, based on federalism, based on all of these concerns about patchworks and chaos, we're going to say Colorado went outside of its power. But then the agreement dissipates, and that's where we lose all consensus. And that's where you have the majority, I think, taking a very different stance, saying, and here's exactly how you apply Section 3, and the concurrent saying, why are you going so far? And you're doing this in a way that not just avoids judicial restraint, but you're kind of tipping the scales in favor of somebody like the former president.
Justice Amy Coney Barrett, in her separate, more temperate concurrence, wrote, "The court has settled a politically charged issue in the volatile season of a presidential election. Particularly in this circumstances, writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up." But then goes on to say, well, the main message is we all agreed.
Right. And I think this is an understandable message by Justice Barrett, because she's very cognizant of the fact that she doesn't want this to be a Bush v. Gore redux, where it looks like by a thinly divided court, divided along ideological lines of who appointed the justices, that they make a decision that has a huge effect on the presidential election. So what she's saying is she understands the concern that the majority went too far, but she wishes that, I think the dissent, excuse me, the Freudian slip, that the concurrence hadn't used such strident language. And I wonder if there was some world in which the liberals actually could have gotten Justice Barrett to sign on if the tenor of the concurrence had maybe been slightly different.
Well, she hasn't been sitting in those liberal seats for so long, particularly Sonia Sotomayor, and the emotion, shall we say, or anger building up. Is Barrett on a sort of a mission? Because she appeared with Sonia Sotomayor at the National Conference of Governors to say there are not Republican judges or Democratic judges. We all wear black robes, not red, not blue. Is she on a mission that you usually see the Chief Justice on?
I think that it's Justice Barrett, it's Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who's also spoken warmly about Justice Clarence Thomas, it's the Chief Justice, it's Elena Kagan, all of whom have said some version of, please know that we're judges, not politicians in robes. And of course, they need that, right? The Supreme Court depends on our respect, and it depends on us viewing them as something different from just political actors, because ultimately they get their power from us saying that they have that power. I mean, they don't have an army to send in. They don't have a group of police officers to send in to enforce their opinions in the sense that they have the power of the pen. And if we ignore that, then we have a real problem with our third branch.
So they don't want to appear as political actors. They want to appear as judges. Yet over the space of 6 days, they gave Trump this outright victory in Colorado and a victory in putting off his criminal case. After waiting for 2 weeks to decide whether or not they were going to take his claim of presidential immunity from prosecution, which may mean, probably will mean, that he won't be tried in the election interference case because there won't be time. How is that not political?
I think what the justices would say is, look, we decided to take this case because we decide big constitutional questions that are matters of first impression. And this is a big constitutional question that we've never confronted before. And I think what they might also say is, Jack Smith came to us in December and asked us to set this for arguments in March. We instead said, you don't get to jump the line. And we set arguments for the end of April. Now, is the end of April quite different, in fact, when it comes to the court calendar and the electoral calendar than the beginning of March? Of course it is. But they can also say, look, we had a full calendar. We didn't push this off until next term. And they might say it's not our responsibility to make sure that this case can occur before the election. Now, on the other hand, of course, one would say, well, are they actually unnecessarily delaying things by, you know, setting this particular pace? But I think the justices would say, actually, we're moving for us quite quickly.
Well, they set it for the last possible day they could for oral arguments. And we saw how fast they did the Colorado case. And that Trump immunity case has been briefed and rebriefed. I don't know what else there is left to say.
Right. I mean, what's left is the Supreme Court decision. And I think what we do need to think about is that we could get a decision that isn't just an up or down. It's not just there is absolute immunity or there isn't. We could get a decision that says, for instance, there is qualified immunity, and send the case back to Judge Chutkan, the trial court judge in the D.C. case dealing with election interference, and tell her to apply that standard. That could also present a delay.
And none of the justices dissented from that order delaying Trump's trial either.
One thing I would offer is, I know we're all very much focused on the question of whether or not the D.C. case, that election interference case, does move forward before the election. But there's also another question looming in that case, in an unrelated case before the Supreme Court, dealing with whether or not the federal statute that Trump is charged under, at least for, I think, half of the charges, whether or not that's appropriate to use in this type of case. And that similarly could have delayed this trial.
And not to be repetitive, but I will be, taking these cases that basically put them in the middle of the presidential election is not going to help to make people think that they're judges in black robes and not politicians.
Well, I think when it came to the Section 3 case of the 14th Amendment, they just didn't have a choice. That's
right.
A case that screams out for Supreme Court review. When it comes to the cases dealing with January 6th and whether or not the obstruction statute that people are charged under is appropriate, I similarly think that probably does cry out for Supreme Court resolution. And then when it comes to this question of presidential immunity, one could argue same thing, constitutional question, matter of first impression, that means Supreme Court.
Well, I'm not sure their approval rating can get any lower, but we'll see. Thanks so much, Jessica. That's Professor Jessica Levinson of Loyola Law School, host of the Passing Judgment podcast. Coming up next, is the SEC's multi-billion dollar enforcement tool in jeopardy? I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Whether or not a defendant has to cough up profits from illegal trading activity may come down to what court securities regulators filed in. That's because U.S. appeals courts disagree about what the SEC needs to show to take back profits from alleged wrongdoers. Is it about how much investors lost, or is it about how much the defendant made from illegal acts? A lot is at stake for the SEC, because disgorgement is one of the most powerful tools it has for taking back those illegal profits. It brought in some $3.37 billion in 2023. That's more than twice what the agency recovered in fines. Joining me is Anthony Sabino, a professor in the Department of Law at the Peter J. Tobin College of Business at St. John's University. Nice to have you back on the show, Anthony.
Well, first of all, let me say I'm delighted to be on the program with you again, and especially today to discuss what I think is going to be the next landmark Supreme Court case in the realm of securities law. It's probably a year away, but again, this is an issue that certainly the Supreme Court should resolve and I think very much needs to resolve.
So how much a defendant will pay to the SEC in disgorgement depends on where they are, what circuit they're in. Just explain this problem.
June, you're correct. It is very much a problem, which is why the Supreme Court is going to eventually have to step in, and I hope sooner as opposed to later. And the reason is there is very much a sharp divide, a deep chasm between a decision from June of 22 called Hallam by the Fifth Circuit, a very prominent circuit indeed, which basically said that disgorgement is regulated by a statutory addition that Congress made in very early 2021 with respect to recognizing disgorgements. And as the Fifth Circuit classified it, is a legal version of the remedy, as opposed to the more recent decision called Govill from October of last year, so it's very fresh, from the eminent Second Circuit. And as we've said many times on the program before, the Second Circuit was long ago recognized by the Supreme Court as the mother court of the federal securities law, and the justices pay a great deal of attention, if not deference, to it. The Second Circuit, in a more recent opinion authored by Circuit Judge Menasche, said, well, no, disgorgement, even with this statutory revision, is still an equitable remedy that is regulated by equitable principles, and paramount among them is that in seeking disgorgement and the amount of money related thereto, the SEC must prove that there are actually investors who were not only defrauded, okay, material misrepresentations, omissions, etc., but they must prove the extent, they must quantify the amount of monetary damage to those investors. In other words, if the SEC can't show there are investors with actual pecuniary harm. There is no basis for disgorgements, and therefore the SEC can recover. And the SEC has basically been using disgorgement for decades to extract illegal profits from malefactors. But the bottom line is, and you now see this limitation placed upon it by the Second Circuit that makes the SEC's case all the much harder, especially in the contemporary environment where we have, for example, cryptocurrency cases where it's difficult and maybe impossible to basically show the quantitative damage, the dollar values, the pecuniary harm to investors. So you have this very sharp chasm between these two circuits.
And how have the other circuits lined up?
There's a pending case before the First Circuit up in Boston that we have yet to hear from, an 11th Circuit case pending down in Florida, and there is prior 11th Circuit case law that sort of takes a middle-of-the-road position. We're not too sure where they're at. The 10th Circuit apparently said something about this. So both qualitatively and quantitatively, the circuits are deeply divided, and that has to be reconciled by the Supreme Court. And finally, the reason the court has to step in my estimation, is the fact that this situation was largely presaged by the Supreme Court's decision in June of 2020 in the Liu versus SEC case, where the court, in an opinion written by Justice Sotomayor, basically defined some of the parameters of disgorgement as an equitable remedy and set forth certain conditions and requirements for the SEC to prove it, and conversely how one defends against such a charge. But it left certain questions unanswered, and that in turn was exacerbated by some statutory revisions made by Congress in June of 2021. And in essence, that's why the Goville case from the Second Circuit and the Hallam case from the Fifth Circuit are at odds, because they take startling different views of what Liu said or did not say and what the statutory revision by Congress did or did not do. So as the final arbiter of our nation's laws, the Supreme Court needs to step in, and especially because, again, disgorgement, both as a deterrent to wrongful behavior and as a just punishment for those who do wrong in the capital markets, we need resolution on this. So I'm looking forward to this case being teed up by one of these parties, one of these cases, hopefully the Goville case, to get to the justices, not this year, but next year.
So can the SEC, in a lot of cases, file anywhere but the Second Circuit?
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, the securities laws give exclusive jurisdiction in most cases to the SEC, and it gives it broad authority to file in whatever district court they think appropriate. Obviously, the district court being the trial court, then it percolates up to the circuit court level. But again, they can get you where the SEC is doing business, where you are doing business, where there are investors who you harmed. Given the quintessential interstate nature of securities transactions, that basically leaves open all the 50 states. So again, the SEC has tremendous choices. So right now, no doubt the folks doing good work at the Division of Enforcement at the SEC in Washington, D.C., not to mention the regional offices, are thinking very long and hard about, okay, where do we bring these cases? If they're seeking disgorgement, they may very well decide, you know what, the Second Circuit is not exactly friendly to us at this point in time, so let's try the Fifth Circuit, which has clearly said this is the legal remedy of disgorgement, and therefore you can ask for it, and here are the rules. And again, they may decide to pick the Fifth Circuit over the Second. They may avoid some of the circuits that are in transition, shall we say, such as the 10th and especially the 1st and the 11th Circuit. And, you know, June, one of the ironies here we can't lose sight of is this. As the Supreme Court pointed out in the Liu decision a couple of years ago, and as both the Goville and Hallam decisions point out, is that disgorgement is really a modern remedy. It's really a judicially crafted remedy that goes back to, of all places, the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit really invented disgorgements back around 1971 in the landmark securities fraud case called Texas Gulf Sulphur. So this is really the Second Circuit having invented disgorgements, or modifying it or applying it to modern securities transactions in the early 70s, and shepherding it through its various transitions. And now we see how they're interpreting guidance from the Supreme Court 2 years ago in the Liu case.
How much does the pecuniary harm standard complicate how the SEC brings cases? I mean, does it need a lot more work up front? We just talked about how, right, in cases where it could bring the actions elsewhere.
Exactly. Okay. Yes, you're completely correct. The SEC will have to do a lot more front-end work, if I may characterize it as such, where not only are they going to have to examine, has fraud been committed, does it meet all the parameters for securities fraud? And once again, remember, the test for securities fraud is rather arduous. The government must prove, and again, we're talking civil cases, so it's just 51%, okay, not beyond a reasonable doubt, that there was a material misrep or omission, there was scienter, in other words, evil intent, there was reliance, there was economic loss, loss causation, a chain of causation with respect to all those events. Oh, and in connection with the purchase or sale of the securities on the American markets. But the bottom line is the commission is now not only going to have to prove the elements of fraud, they're going to have to get down into the weeds and assure themselves that there is a cognizable body of investors who have again been defrauded and not only flim-flam, not only deceived, but they suffered pecuniary harm, and that has to be measurable, that has to be quantifiable, certainly in the Second Circuit's opinion with respect to the Govill decision. And again, what this highlights, June, is one of the conflicts, the tension between the existing law prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Liu and the amendments that Congress made basically 6 months later. Liu was predicated upon one subsection of Section 78U, okay, the complexity of the federal securities laws is astounding. But basically the existing section...
Astounding.
Right.
That's one thing that no one disagrees with.
That's for sure. We all know it's astounding, but it gives us something to talk about, does it not? So the existing law talked about how the SEC can seek any equitable remedy as long as it's for the benefit of investors. And by the way, that's crucial to the Govill decision because it said, okay, benefit to investors means that to benefit them, you have to find someone who was harmed, and the purpose of the equitable remedy, whatever it might be, is to restore them to where they should have been had they not been defrauded, okay? And as Judge Menasche points out so well, he states, if there's no pecuniary harm, that means that if you give these folks money via disgorgement or some other equitable remedy, you're not putting them back where they should have been. You're improving their position. It's a windfall, okay? And that's not what justice is all about. On the other hand, and this is where, again, we see the chasm between the circuits, the Fifth Circuit in Halam focused upon the amendment from January 2021 that says disgorgement. And again, the SEC may seek disgorgement in federal district court. It doesn't define what disgorgement is. It does not say that the disgorgement has to be for the benefit of investors. And that's why Halam basically says you don't have to find investors suffering a pecuniary harm. That's where they basically parted ways with the Second Circuit. And indeed, the bottom line is Govill was presaged by a prior Second Circuit case called Ahmed. And so the chronology, limited chronology, is Second Circuit says such and such in Ahmed. The Fifth Circuit, July 2022, disagrees in Halam. And now the Second Circuit in October of 2023 says, no, we're right, you're wrong. And again, you see this division. But again, that's the whole point because now, and this is why the Supreme Court very much needs to step in because they have to say, okay, wait a minute. When Congress enacted the newer provision that talks about disgorgements, did it adopt any of the court's principles regarding equitable remedies from the Liu case? The irony is if Congress had been more direct in defining its newer version of disgorgements, we wouldn't have this issue to start with.
It is so complicated. Thanks so much for your explanations, Anthony. That's Anthony Sabino, a professor in the Department of Law at the Peter J. Tobin College of Business at St. John's University. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.